When in 1953, two young researchers in England, James Watson and Francis Crick, deciphered the structure of DNA, their work was hailed as a triumph of the human spirit, of the centuries-old quest to understand the universe in a scientific way. It was confidently expected that their discovery would be selflessly extended to the greater benefit of mankind. Yet that did not happen. 30 years later, nearly all of Watson and Crick's scientific colleagues were engaged in another sort of enterprise entirely. Research in molecular genetics had become a vast, multi-billion dollar commercial undertaking, and its origins can be traced not to 1953, but to April 1976. That was the date of a now famous meeting in which Robert Swanson, a venture capitalist, approached Herbert Boyer, a biochemist at the University of California. The two men agreed to found a commercial company to exploit Boyer's gene splicing techniques. Their new company, Genentech, quickly became the largest and most successful of the genetic engineering startups. Suddenly it seemed as if everyone wanted to become rich. New companies were announced almost weekly, and scientists flocked to exploit genetic research. By 1986, at least 362 scientists, including 64 in the National Academy, sat on the advisory boards of biotech firms. The number of those who held equity positions or consultancies was several times greater. It is necessary to emphasize how significant this shift in attitude actually was. In the past, pure scientists took a snobbish view of business. They saw the pursuit of money as intellectually uninteresting, suited only to shopkeepers. And to do research for industry, even at the prestigious Bell or IBM labs, was only for those who couldn't get a university appointment. Thus, the attitude of pure scientists was fundamentally critical toward the work of applied scientists and to industry in general. Their long-standing antagonism kept university scientists free of contaminating industry ties, and whenever debate arose about technological matters, disinterested scientists were available to discuss the issues at the highest levels. But that is no longer true. There are very few molecular biologists and very few research institutions without commercial affiliations. The old days are gone. Genetic research continues at a more furious pace than ever, but it is done in secret and in haste and for profit. In this commercial climate, it is probably inevitable that a company as ambitious as International Genetic Technologies Incorporated of Palo Alto would arise. It is equally unsurprising that the genetic crisis it created should go unreported. After all, InGen's research was conducted in secret. The actual incident occurred in the most remote region of Central America, and fewer than 20 people were there to witness it. Of those, only a handful survived. Even at the end, when International Genetic Technologies filed for Chapter 11 protection in San Francisco Superior Court on October 5, 1989, the proceedings drew little press attention. It appeared so ordinary. InGen was the third small American bioengineering company to fail that year, and the seventh since 1986. Few court documents were made public, since the creditors were Japanese investment consortia such as Hamaguri and Densaka, companies which traditionally shun publicity. To avoid unnecessary disclosure, Daniel Ross of Cowan Swain & Ross, counsel for InGen, also represented the Japanese investors. And the rather unusual petition of the vice consul of Costa Rica was heard behind closed doors. Thus, it is not surprising that within a month, the problems of InGen were quietly and amicably settled. Parties to that settlement, including the distinguished scientific board of advisors, signed a non-disclosure agreement, and none will speak about what happened. But many of the principal figures in the InGen incident are not signatories, and were willing to discuss the remarkable events leading up to those final 2 days in August 1989 on a remote island off the west coast of Costa Rica.